Good evening. Where sometimes the Jews suffered exclusively, sometimes as cities expanded, sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yona ben Reb Aryeh Leib. The First Crusade, 1096, resulted in the Christian conquest of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, and had one immediate consequence: the destruction of the Karaite community, which was the largest in the world at the time, in Yerushalayim. So the Karaites had been the majority population in Yerushalayim for about a century and a half before, even fancying themselves the true Aveli Tzion, the mourners of Tzion, and they were very, very passionate Zionists of a sort. They clung to Eretz Yisrael. But in 1099, all the Jews of Yerushalayim, including the Karaites, were herded into a shul and burnt alive. And the Jewish community in Yerushalayim did not exist for most of the 12th century. The Karaites, as it were, reestablished themselves in Egypt. We'll encounter them again a little later on. But mainly in Asia Minor, where their descent into irrelevance would be hastened. Now, in Yerushalayim, in 1099, the Dome of Barak was converted into a church. And throughout the land of Israel, relatively very few Jews remained, but there were small Jewish communities. In real numbers, it was very, very low. Meanwhile, the shockwaves that were unleashed by the First Crusade in Europe did not soon recede. It was a staggering blow. Although the human toll in the low thousands was not high, certainly compared to the numbers to which we've become accustomed, the psychological blow was devastating. Jews now lived in Christian lands without security at all. In the 12th century, the same would be true, to a lesser extent, but also true in the Muslim lands. And the expectation grew, that was borne out by the next 9 centuries, that Christian violence against Jews would erupt suddenly and dreadfully, like a wintry blizzard that materializes every few years, and there was little that the Jews could do but weather the storm. Although the word would not enter general usage until the 19th century, pogrom, which is a Russian word, pogroms would explode every so often in the 12th century and thereon, for a variety of reasons, none of which make Christians look good. The church would use violence against Jews as a tool, manipulating their followers for religious or political or economic reasons to release their pent-up frustrations against the easiest, handiest target, the Jews. Jews would be attacked because we stubbornly refused to convert or disappear. Jews would be attacked because kingdom come had not yet come. And for that the perfidious Jews were blamed. Jews would be attacked because rulers needed someone for their persecuted followers to themselves persecute, or to keep them docile, or at least riled up against someone other than their oppressors. And persistently, Jews would be attacked because Jews often prospered and made the peasants, the serfs, the common people, bitter and envious. So the attacks, therefore, had several different groups of perpetrators, sometimes working jointly, other times working severally, the bishops, the feudal leaders, local demagogues, and peasants. In each group, there were always people who protected Jews, but no group could be relied on to act in a consistently moral or compassionate way. So the 12th century would see other attacks and regular attacks on Jews wherever we were. Now, European Jews suffered in ways that Sephardic Jews did not. Europe was a much less educated place at the time. Most Europeans, most Christians were illiterate, whereas the average Jew could read. Certainly the average Jew was more familiar with the world of thought and ideas, as embodied in halacha and other things. But Jew was usually on a higher scholastic or intellectual level than the non-Jew. Generally, higher knowledge was frowned upon in Europe, and Christians were superstitious and kept that way by their masters. Now, one of the problems was that Jews were widely used as money lenders, which today we just say they're in finance, which is basically the same thing. The levying of interest, not that it's a very respected profession today, but I guess it wasn't then either. The levying of interest on loans being forbidden to Christians, and that engendered both prosperity for Jews as well as enmity from the serfs. In many places already in the 12th century, Jews were forced to live in what became known in the 16th century as ghettos, residential quarters that were just for Jews, usually located in the least desirable part of town, that is to say, along the river where the banks were the lowest, so that when the river is flooded or overflowed, to which Rabbi Levi responded, "You've exposed our shame." And he really had no answer. Jews were forcibly moved from the worst part of town to the next worst part of town. As the town grew, I saw this myself in Nuremberg, where the Jewish quarter is now the town square, and the Jews were pushed off even along the banks of the river even further. You recall that in 1096, the three towns of the Rhineland, Speyer, Vermeise, and Mainz, were destroyed, but Jews soon returned and rebuilt in all three cities that were ravaged. In fact, Speyer's mikveh, the mikveh of Shapira, still exists and was first mentioned in documents in 1126, documents that are still extant. That mikveh actually still exists. As far as I know, it's still used. Jews in Europe, those not in finance, and only a few were in finance, worked as artisans or farmers or manufacturers or shopkeepers, a relative handful, usually the intellectually gifted, whose parents were supported, were sent to the main yeshivas in France and Germany to learn and then to serve the Jewish people. It's important to keep in mind that lifespan was very short. Some of the Gedolim lived long lives, but people lived into their 40s and 50s, and not more than that. Jews therefore married young, and Jews died young as well. Most were not wealthy by any stretch, and the typical Jew eked out a living amid a constant fear of persecution. Now this is verified by a very succinct statement that you find in Tosfos and Kiddushin, Daf Mem Aleph Amud Aleph, the beginning of the second parak of Kiddushin. The Gemara there states that it's forbidden to marry off one's daughter while she's a katana, that's less than 12 years of age. And yet Tosfos notes, and we're talking about this era, V'achshov, now, sh'anu nohagim l'kadesh b'nosein afilu katanos, now that the custom is to marry off our children, even when they're younger than 12, haynu mishum she'b'chol yom v'yom, that's because every day, ha'golos mizgaber aleinu, the exile overwhelms us. V'im yesh sipek b'yad odom achshov l'seiz levito nedunyo, if now man has the wherewithal to give a dowry for his daughter, Shemela achar zman lo yesipek biyado, maybe in a short time, because of not only changing economic circumstances, but the fear of a pogrom and the looting of their property, in time he might not have it. Viteshe bito aguna la'olam, and his daughter will just sit chained for life. Aguna here doesn't mean aguna someone who's married and can't get a divorce. Aguna means someone sitting home and nobody wants to marry her because there's no dowry. So you could see how the current of the times and the pressures on the Jews led to that anomaly in the 12th century of girls being married off at 9, 10, 11 years of age. We quoted Tosos, and of course the 12th century was the era of the Bale Tosos. Rashi's family and his followers dominated the 12th century and Ashkenazic Jewry, and they became the Bale Tosfos. His student, Rav Simcha Vitri, produced the Machzor Vitri that I mentioned last time. Machzor Vitri is a commentary on the entire Siddur with the halachos of Tila and Shabbos and Yom Tov and Kashrus, Taras and Mishpacha, Tfil and Tzitzis, etc., and it became a basic guide for Ashkenazic Jewry. Rashi had only daughters. One of the sons-in-law, Rabbi Yehuda ben Noson, the Rivan, married Rashi's daughter Alvina. He wrote a Perush on the Talmud, in addition to finishing Rashi's commentary on Makos. But his commentary on the Talmud, the Rivan's commentary, is very often cited by the Bali Tosfos. The more famous son-in-law was Reb Meir ben Shmuel, who died 1130. He married Rashi's daughter Yocheved. He returned to learn. He was born in Germany, went to France to learn under Rashi, and walked off with one of his daughters. Then he went back to Worms, Vermeisa, to learn under Rashi's teacher, Yitzhak Halevi, and he founded a yeshiva in Ramrup, France, which became a center of the Bali Tosfos. And his sons, the sons of Meir ben Shmuel, Rashi's grandsons, they were the Torah giants of Ashkenazic Jewry in the 12th century. Starting with the Rashbam, Reb Shmuel ben Meir lived a long life, 1085 to 1174, 89 years. He was only 19 when his grandfather died, but the Rashbam both studied with his grandfather and disputed him in several areas, with the ever-humble Rashi conceding at times that his grandson was right. Like his grandfather Rashi, the Rashbam also owned a vineyard, but he also owned sheep, and he processed and sold wool. The Rashbam is most famous, is a commentary at the end of Pesachim and Baba Basra, but he's most famous for his commentary on the Torah, which is published in the Mikros Gedolos. There, the Rashbam focused on Pshat. He's very terse, very concise, and he focused on the plain meaning of the Pasuk, feeling that earlier commentators had deviated from the plain meaning of the text by introducing Midrashim in their commentaries. Who's he talking about? His grandfather, Rashi. Another brother, the Rivam, Reb Yitzchak ben Meir, died young at 40, and he is quoted in Tosfos almost 70 times, such a Perush Rivam. Both these brothers, they had a third brother as well, a fourth brother, but they were exceeded by their younger, in Torah greatness exceeded, by their younger brother Yaakov. Yaakov ben Meir, known after Yaakov in the Torah, Ish Tam Yoshev Olim, known as Rabbeinu Tam, born 1100, died 1171. So of course he was only four when Rashi died. He learned under his father, Reb Meir ben Shmuel, and learned under his brother, the Rashbam, in Ramrup, the Na Yeshiva. Rabbeinu Tam was acclaimed as a genius while still young. And his shiurim in Ramrup became the foundation for the work of the Tosfos. Tosafot literally mean additions or supplements. And Rabbeinu Tam's style was that he analyzed Rashi's commentary on the Talmud, and then he contrasted different Gemaros with each other. You take a Gemara in the Masechta that you're learning and contrast it by asking a question from a Gemara in a different Masechta altogether in order to isolate and underscore the different halachic principles underlying both, that is to say the similarities and differences in their basic elements. Now this approach to Talmud Torah became the primary method of study among Ashkenazic Jewry, and in some sense it still is today. The notion of extracting the svara, the reasoning that motivates a particular halachic conclusion, and contrasting it with cases that differ in one or two facts, in order to determine what was the essential point, the Ikar Machlokes. Those fortunate enough to go to law school remember the case study method of studying different subjects of law, where you're presented with different cases that are similar, and you have to be able to extract the point that distinguishes between them. This case study method of law is really very similar to what Tosfos did. I remember when I was in law school, the first week we were assigned a study group, and there were five of us. Four had been in yeshiva for many, many years until law school, and one was a woman, a young woman, who was assigned at random. And we were dealing with the first day's cases, and we're darshaning up this case versus that case. So I remember she said to us, "Have you studied this before?" So I said that we've been studying this our whole lives. because that's what it was. The training that you get in this type of analysis that Rabbeinu Tam pioneered was natural when it came to other areas of law. Now this type of lumdus surely existed before, but it was now systemized because of Rashi's commentary and by Rabbeinu Tam's teaching. Talmud study was forever revolutionized, and since then, Jews who studied Talmud looked to Tosfos, the Tosafos, to clarify, to elucidate any Talmudic passage, because Tosfos was not a person, right? If someone ever says Tosfos says, it's grammatically incorrect. It's really Tosafos say, because it's a plural. Tosafos are these additions. So there are many different manuscripts of the Tosfos, written by many different individuals, and the school of the Tosfos, as such, lasted approximately 150 years. To list their names is not only to know many of the giants of the Rishonim of Ashkenaz, but also reads like a travelogue of France. Reb Yitzchok of Dampierre, Rashi's great-grandson, known as the Ri Hazoken, his student, Reb Shimshon of Son, known as the Rosh Misan, or they say in Yeshiva, the Rosh Mishans, but it's Son, Reb Elio of Paris, Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, who's the author of the Sefer Yireim. The Yireim is famous for a number of things, perhaps mostly for us codifying that Havlokas Ner Shabbos is 20 minutes before Shkia. We follow the sheet of the Yireim in lighting candles then. The Gemara says you light candles before Shkia. But the Yireim decreed, Rabbi Eliezer Mimetz, that candlelight is 20 minutes before Zahar Hayom, that's what the Jews do. And of course there are many others. And Rabbeinu Tam himself wrote the Sefer HaYoshar, it's a work of Halacha and Musar, and he wrote poetry as well. Now Rabbeinu Tam never hesitated to disagree with his grandfather, the two famous disputes, the second of which Rashi ruled that a mezuzah is placed on the door vertically. Rabbeinu Tam ruled the mezuzah is placed on the door, on the doorpost, doorpost horizontally. So a classic Ashkenaz compromise, we slant the mezuzah on the diagonal. Someone said recently that's because every house has shalom bayis, or should have shalom bayis. So when you walk into the house, you see the mezuzah on the diagonal, not vertical or horizontal. It's a reminder that in a house there has to be compromise, and this year is a compromise between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam's psak in this area. Of course, the more famous machlokas is on tefillin. Rashi's tefillin, it's all based on Gemara in the Menachos stuff, Lamed Gimel, Lamed Dalet, Lamed Aleph. It's not really machlokas Rashi Rabbeinu Tam, because he had both shitas, but nonetheless, Rashi's tefillin follows the order, the parshas are placed in the order in which they are written in the Torah. Kadesh Kol Bechor, V'hoya Kiviacha, both of them parshas Bo, and then Shman, V'Shanon, and V'hoyam Shemoa in Akev. That's Rashi's tefillin. Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin juxtaposes the two V'hoyos, V'hoya Kiviacha and V'hoya im Shemoa. So now it's interesting. On the tefillin Shel Rosh, it's four separate little scrolls, little klafim. But the tefillin Shel Yad is all one scroll. So if you have to write it, Kisidra, you have to write in order, how do you produce Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? Because V'hoya has to be before Shema. How does it produce? A large space is left for V'hoya, so they write Kadesh, V'hoya Keviacho, at the end, Shema, leaving a big space for V'hoya, and then putting V'hoya in Shema right in the middle. That machlokas, of course, is unresolved. We pass them like Rashi. Most follow Rashi, the Bali Nefesh, where Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin as well. It's hard to underestimate Rabbeinu Tam's place in the world of Torah, and why should we? 2 centuries later, the Rivosh, Reb Yitzchak Bar Sheshes, wrote in North Africa, in his Trubos, in Shin Sadi Dalid, that the two great luminaries who sustained, who brightened the world of Torah, Rashi was the first, and he said, Hamaor Hasheni, the second luminary, Rabbeinu Yaakov Ishtam, Rabbeinu Tam, Asher Kamohu V'Filpul Lonia Me'achash HaTalmud Nechtam, that his his depth of analysis is unparalleled from the time the Talmud was sealed. Talmud Aruch Befiv, the Talmud is set in his mouth, the Shogor is fluent. Sinai's tremendous memory. Va'oker har v'tochan v'zebazeh. He takes mountains and grinds them together, meaning he can analyze different areas of the Talmud. Mipilpulo v'emek sichlo urchav binaso kol chacham lev hengor yogur. From his analysis, from the depth of his intellect, from the breadth of his wisdom, every wise person can dwell therein. V'shar kochavim chachmei tzarfatim, and the other stars, the wise men of France, mipihem anu choyin mimehen anu shosim. We live from their mouths and we drink from their water. This said the Rivash 2 centuries later in Algeria. Now, notwithstanding their intellectual greatness and their importance to Jews, Rabbeinu Tam and the Baalei Tosfos were regularly persecuted by Christians. Rabbeinu Tam is very often mentioned. You know, some of his Piskei Halacha come down to us and are cited. He's the one, the first one to permit shaving on Chol HaMoed, for example. But because of Rabbeinu Tam's psak, our halachic interactions with Christians changed. Rabbeinu Tam did affirm, contrary to what you hear on the street sometimes, that Christianity was Avodah Zarah, but he distinguished between them and the pagans of antiquity in regard to commercial dealings. So therefore, all the limitations that you find in the first paragraph of the Maseches Avodah Zarah about doing business with non-Jews before, during, and after their holidays, he said none of that applied to Christians, because despite being idolaters, they're not idolaters like existed in ancient times. And yet he was not spared. In 1146, the Second Crusades entered Ramruk, plundered his home, defiled the Sefer Torah Rabbeinu Tam had in his home, and he himself was stabbed 5 times in the head. Somehow, by a miracle, he survived, saved by a nobleman. These Second Crusades, under the auspices of Pope Eugenius III and a monk, Bernard of Clairvaux, took few Jewish lives, but again, this is about a half century after the first, destroyed any sense of stability that Jews would have. Worse than that, Rabbeinu Tam died in 1171, soon after a blood libel in Blois in France led to the burning of 31 Jews. That day, Chof Sivan was declared a tainus by Rabbeinu Tam that many Jews in Ashkenaz observed for centuries. Some still today, in fact, you still find calendars. I think the Ezra Star Luach even mentions Chof Sivan as an optional fast. Now, the blood libel in Blois was not the first. There was no rest anywhere in Europe, and the first major eruption in this sense took place in England, in Norwich. Norwich was, at the time, the second largest city in England after London. Norwich was the scene of a notorious blood libel in 1144. Jews were accused of crucifying a young boy, 12 years old, named William, right before Pesach, and the word spread, as we became accustomed to. Now, the Christians attributed, they recovered the body, stabbed, they attributed miracles to this young child, and he became Saint William, who's still revered until today. At the time, the king protected the Jews. He knew that the charges were false. But 2 years later, the new bishop of Norwich did not, and Jews were attacked. These accusations of ritual murder and blood libel, especially around Pesach time, became commonplace in England in the 12th century, with charges in Gloucester in 1168, in St. Edmunds in 1181, in Bristol in 1183. These accusations were not only the result of religious animus, but of course they also served the purpose of deflecting attention from the real murderers. In 1189, after the coronation of Richard the Lionhearted, all the Jews of Norwich were massacred, 1189. Meanwhile, in 1182, King Philip II of France expelled all the Jews from France. Fortunately, the Baalei Tosfos had largely relocated to Germany, led by Rav Shmuel HaChassid of Speyer and the Rihalovon, his brother of Safi of Regensburg, Rav Ephraim of Bonn. Rav Ephraim of Bonn wrote a chronicle of the persecution of Jews in France, Germany, and England during the 12th century, and others as well. One infamous episode, 1190, in England, the Jews of York were the victims of a terrible pogrom under siege. They took refuge in Clifford's Tower, a fortress still stands in York, where eventually 150 Jews were burned to death. There's a keynote we have in our keynotes for Tisha B'Av that commemorates the massacre of the Jews of York. So, modern update. Clifford's Tower still stands. A few years ago, there was a proposal to raise the area and build a retail shopping center. And Jews were among the groups that opposed the proposal this more than 800 years after the massacre. The Christian invasion of Israel also met a terrible fate, as the Second Crusade was unsuccessful in furthering Christian holdings in the Middle East and even forced them to retreat. And they finally met their comeuppance at the hands of a Kurdish warrior named Salah ad-Din, known better as Saladin. Salah ad-Din was not an Arab, although they really claimed him as a hero. He was a Kurd. He expelled the Crusaders. He mounted a defense of Cairo, Egypt. Then he entered Israel, and after almost two decades of fighting, he expelled the Crusaders from Yerushalayim in 1187. The climactic battle took place at Karnei Chitin on July 4th, 1187, about 5 miles west of Tveria. Crusader forces were decimated. Salah ad-Din treated the conquered with considerably more grace than they had shown the Muslims 90 years earlier, and most Christian captives were able to ransom themselves, and they joined the Christian communities on the Mediterranean coast of Israel. But the heart of Yerushalayim was again Muslim in 1187 and would remain Muslim until 1967. One other point to keep in mind, of course, the Dome of the Rock had been converted to a church. Now it was again converted into the shrine. Al-Aqsa was also a church then. Both converted back to their Muslim use as a mosque and a shrine. The only time in history where a conqueror did not replace a house of worship on the Temple Mount with his own was after 1967, when Israel left what was there. The Third Crusade in 1191, led by Richard the Lionhearted and the aforementioned King Philip of France and Germany's Frederick, sputtered and failed short of conquering Yerushalayim. There'd be several other crusades. They're mainly successful, Rahman al-Sana, killing Jews, but they're never again successful in gaining any sort of foothold in the Middle East. Salah ad-Din had been helped by the Jews of Egypt, invited Jews to return and settle in Yerushalayim. Remember again, Jews had been massacred after the First Crusades. A few Jews did. Most Jews, though, lived elsewhere in the country, in Akko, Hebron, in the Galil. But of course, Salah ad-Din became famous as the liberator of Yerushalayim, and therefore you can ride on his street today. The street stretching in Yerushalayim from Shar Shechem to eastward to Shara Prachim and around the old city, that's Rehov Salah ad-Din. Meanwhile, the Jews of Spain would see the end of their golden age in the 12th century, but not before producing some of the greatest Jews we've ever known. Firstly, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was born in 1080, died 1145, is disciple of the Rif and of Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash. He's a poet. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote over 800 poems, including 350 piyutim. Not all the poems were holy poems. He wrote secular love poetry as well. Regretted it later in life. Couldn't find a publisher, I guess. He was a physician, philosopher. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was born in Toledo and is most famous for the Sefer Kuzari that he wrote, a comprehensive philosophical work, a dialogue between a rabbi and the king of the Khazars, a full articulation of what Jews believe. You think back a few sessions, we discussed the kingdom of the Khazars that had converted en masse to Judaism. Rabbi Yehuda Levi recreated what might have been a discussion, what might have led that king to convert with his kingdom, by discussing the weaknesses of the other religions and the truth of the Yadus and every aspect, halacha, philosophy, of what makes Jews Jews, and the king was impressed. In a sense, he was the first Zionist. He was a passionate lover of Eretz Yisrael. He composed some of the keynotes that we say on Tisha B'Av, beginning Tzion, even died in Israel, making Aliyah in his old age. The legend is he was trampled by an Arab horseman when he came to the gates of Yerushalayim. But mostly for one small vignette or exchange that he records in the Sefer Kuzari. He's talking about the virtues of Eretz Yisrael, as God gave us the land, and etc. And the king says to him, "You make such a strong case. If so, how come the Jews don't live there?" To which Rabbi Yehuda Levi responded, "You've exposed our shame." And he really had no answer for the king, and that's how it's left. Now, he did write secular poetry as well, and Zmiros, the famous Zemer of Rabbi Yehuda Levi, Yom Shabbason, Ein Lishkoach, Zichro Koreach and Yichoach. The Kuzari was translated from Arabic into Hebrew by Rabbi Yehuda Ibn Tibon of Granada. He was the first of the great translators. Rabbi Shmuel Ibn Tibon was another, there was a third too. He also translated from Arabic into Hebrew, meaning making it accessible to the Ashkenazic world, Emunos Videos of Rabbi Sajigo, Mechavos HaLavavos of Rabbeinu Bachya, Ibn Gabirol's work. His method was not to translate literally, but to convey the ideas, to convey the author's true thoughts, which of course is a much better translation. He was a great Spanish poet and philosopher named Ramosha Ibn Ezra, but more famous to us is a distant relative of his, Rav Avraham Ibn Ezra, known to us just as the Ibn Ezra. Born in 1089, died in 1164, is one of the greatest commentators on Tanakh, but he lived a tortured life. Ibn Ezra fled the Almoravid uprising in Spain in 1135, and he wound up in Rome, where he began writing his Perush on Chumash. He had a son who moved to Baghdad. That son converted to Islam. Subsequently did tshuva, but the Ibn Ezra took it as a punishment, and he began a life of wandering, literally across the globe, from Israel to London, wandering so much, it's unknown where he died and is buried. There are four or five guesses, including Israel, Rome, Spain, France, and England. Ibn Ezra could never make a living. He started and failed a number of businesses to the point that he wrote about himself, and he was a poet as well. He said, "If I sold candles, the sun would stop setting. And if I sold shrouds, people would stop dying." Whatever he did, he was not matzliach in business. He too, in his pshat on Chumash and Nach, focused on pshat. He was very often caustic in his criticism of others, as was common at the time. He was born in Tudela, which of course was the home of Rav Binyamin of Tudela, the great traveler, who literally spanned the globe. He departed in 1160, traveling from Spain to the Orient and back, arriving in Spain via Sicily in 1173. So he traveled for 13 years, visiting Jewish communities across the world, in China, in India, in Africa, wherever. He apparently was the first European, Jew or non-Jew, to actually mention China in his writings. He left behind a work called Masa'ot of Rav Binyamin of Tudela, which of course is extant, the travels in which he described what he saw, his interactions with Jews across the world, how Jews live, there's Minhagim, etc. Very interesting work. Another great Spanish Jew, the Ravid, Avram ben David, known as Ravid the First, because there'll be three great Ravids. He wrote a book called the Sefer Kabbalah, which, like the Igeres of Rav Shreiragon, traced the entire Mesorah, from Moshe's time until his time. This Rivet was executed in Toledo in 1180 for refusing to convert to Christianity. Then you have the famous Kimchi family, Reb Yosef and his son Reb David Kimchi, the Radak, each of whom wrote commentaries on Tanakh. Each eventually moved to Provence. In fact, Reb Yosef moved there as an adult, dragging along his son as an infant. They moved to Provence in southern France. Provence became a Torah center led by Reb Yitzchak of Mervan, who started a yeshiva in Narbonne. Other Jewish communities in southern France, which became a refuge really for Jews of Spain, in Marseille, Montpellier, Avignon, which in the 14th century would become the seat of the papacy, and Carpentras. Among the Spanish giants who reside in Provence was Rabbeinu Zrachya Halevi, known to us as the Baal HaMo'or, originally from Girona in Spain, but raised and resided in Provence. So he wrote his eponymous work, the Baal HaMo'or, at the age of 18. He's quite young. It's a commentary on the Rif. He also brooked no dissent. He had a very, very sharp tongue. He wrote of himself in his youthful work in the introduction that you can find Yayin Yoshem Bikli Chadash. You could find old wine in a new vessel, meaning himself. And this commentary on the Rif, of course, is printed beneath the Rif in our Gemaras. But all of these Gedolim pale before the Nesher HaGadol, the great eagle, and that is the Rambam. Rav Moshe ben Maimon was born 1135, died in 1204, so he is worth several lectures by himself. And he is a person like Rashi who dominates the study of Torah until today. You can't learn Tanakh without Rashi. For that matter, you can't learn Talmud without Rashi, but you can't learn Halacha without the Rambam. It's impossible to study the Talmud, Halacha, especially after the Brisker Revolution of 125 years ago, without reckoning with the Rambam. So much so that people think he's Lithuanian. I'll tell you a story, one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. Years ago, a guy in my old shul told me he was sitting in a yeshiva in New York, so I won't say which yeshiva, just listening to, he's in the upper high school or lower base medrash class, and the kids were talking about who's greater, you know, the Sardin, the Ashkenazim, Lithuanians, the Germans, who are the greatest Tamei Chachamim. I guess in a different age, they would argue, who was the better center fielder, Mays, Mantle, or Snyder? He doesn't know who the Gedolim. So he's eavesdropping, and one young man says, well, clearly the Lithuanians have the greatest Tamei Chachamim because the Sephardim, have they ever produced someone like the Rambam? Of course not. So it had to be one of the dumbest comments I've ever heard. We're not talking a child, by the way. We're talking about an old debacher in yeshiva who just assumed the Rambam was a Lithuanian because only the Lithuanians seemed to quote him. Of course, the Rambam signed his name, Reb Moshe HaSfardi. He was born in Cordoba. He was the son of the Dayan of Cordoba. Maimon was his first teacher. The Rambam's life was buffeted by very turbulent winds, and yet, as would be recorded on his tombstone, Mimoshe vad Moshe lokom kemoshe. From Moshe Rabbeinu to Moshe ben Maimon, there is no such great figure. The Rambam had to flee Cordoba at age 13 with his father and brother after the Almohad invasion of Spain. And it's supposed to backtrack a little and look at what Spanish Jews were living through at the time. So the Jews of Spain lived in relative tranquility, the emphasis on relative, compared to Christian Europe, it was serene. But in real terms, trouble and persecution always loomed under the surface. Keep in mind, Spain was divided. The northern half was Christian, the southern half was Muslim. It was part of the problem. Of course, Jews could play one against the other, but both could persecute Jews as well. There were troubled relations between the Christians and the Muslims. Always having these skirmishes because they each coveted each other's territory. Both harbored resentments against Jews. So we already discussed the last century pogroms in Cordoba and Granada that claimed many Jewish lives in the 11th century. In 1033, 6,000 Jews were killed in Fez, Morocco by Muslims. the pressure to convert in the Christian part of Spain was constant. So, for example, in 1106, a Jew named Moshe Hasfardi, not Barambam, of course, Moshe Hasfardi is a physician to Alfonso I, the king of Aragon. He converted to Catholicism, took the name Petrus Alfonsi, Alfonso's Peter. He became, as many apostates did, an anti-Jewish polemicist, writing and preaching against Jews, claiming that Jews had abandoned the Torah for a life of the Talmud, which at its core was the Karaite claim as well. In 1108, another Jewish physician in Alfonso's court, Shlomo, was murdered, it's recorded, and that was a prelude to the widespread massacre of Jews in Toledo and elsewhere in 1109. And for the next decade, Jews were even banned from Toledo in 1118. Toledo's a walled city. When you're banned, you're really outside the wall. Christian advances agitated Muslims who felt they weren't pious enough, and Jews paid the price. As it was, Islam was often at war with itself. To an extent, it still is. In 1149, the Almohads, a fanatical Moorish Muslim sect from North Africa, invaded southern Spain, and they conquered it from the Almoravids, who themselves had conquered a few decades earlier. Jews were then offered the choice in southern Spain of converting to Islam or death. Many converted, outwardly or inwardly. Others fled to northern Christian Spain or to Provence or to North Africa. As is traditional, Agavurja, there's a statue in Cordoba marking the birthplace of the Rambam. Of course, it omits any mention that he had to flee Cordoba for his life when he was just a young man. Now, ironically, the Almohad invasion improved life for the Jews in Christian Spain, because the Christians, fearing further Muslim encroachments, then reached out to the Jews for support. But many Jews fled. The Rambam's family did all of the above. They first hid in southern Spain, then they fled to Christian Spain, and finally in 1160 they made their way to Fez, Morocco. The Jews of Fez were also under Almohad rule, and they converted to Islam en masse, but as a sham. They still practiced mitzvahs in private, and the local rulers were satisfied. But during his travels and his travails, the Rambam began to write. His first major work, begun in his 20s, was a comprehensive commentary on the Mishnah, written in Arabic, his Perush HaMishnayos, including the Shmoneh Prakim, a philosophical introduction to Maseches Avos, and the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikarim, which are found at the end of his Perush on Maseches Sanhedrin, Perek Chelek, his 13 principles of faith. To the Jews of Fez, later to Jews elsewhere in the Islamic Empire, who were being taught by some that they should martyr themselves rather than convert to Islam, the Rambam penned what's called the Igeres HaShmad, or the Maamar Kiddush Hashem, that encouraged them and taught that Islam was not idolatry, although a false religion wasn't idolatrous, and so they could profess anything orally. The conversion to Islam was just stating that you accept God and Muhammad. They could say those words and return to Shmiras HaMitzvos and to Torah, no questions asked. Later, the Rambam wrote a similar letter to the Jews of Yemen, and he became a tremendous hero to the Jews of Yemen. One of their rabbanim they had consulted, not a Yemenite though, had told them that they're gone. They've written themselves out of the Jewish people, traitors. And the Rambam said exactly the opposite, that all they have to do is do mitzvahs, and they're welcome back. And that's what Yemenite Jews, for many years, would append to their Kaddish, B'chai Chon, Uv'yom Echon, Uv'chai de Moshe ben Maimon. They would honor him in the text of the Kaddish. But with all this advice about pretending to practice Islam, the Rambam said it's far better to live in freedom. So if you don't have to pretend or make any declarations at all, you should find a place without persecution. So with that, the Rambam left in 1165 and went to Eretz Yisrael. There he traveled across the country, but coming under the yoke of the Crusaders, who were making life difficult for Jews, made it impossible for the Rambam to remain there. So he left for Egypt in 1166, settling in Fostat, old Cairo, where he remained, and he almost immediately became the leader, the Nagid of Egyptian Jewry, devoting himself to Talmud Torah and nothing else. This would change dramatically, suddenly, and tragically. So how does a person learn Torah and not work? You need a patron. The Rambam had a patron. You need a community. Okay. The Rambam had a patron, and that was his brother David, who was a wealthy diamond merchant who did business and supported the Rambam, your classic Yisachar Zvulun relationship. In 1169, though, just a few years after Rambam returned to Egypt, David was lost at sea, his ship sank in the Indian Ocean, and with him, all his wealth, all his precious stones. In a moment, the Rambam became destitute. By many accounts, the Rambam fell into a depression that lasted more than a year after he emerged with a profession, physician. And he became a prominent physician, later becoming the physician to the local monarch, who was a courtier of Salah ad-Din. With his financial worries gone, and the Jews benefiting from their support of Salah ad-Din in his wars, a new period of creativity and prosperity for the Jews of Egypt began, and the Rambam himself began producing works that enlighten us until today. Primarily the Mishneh Torah, which he began writing in 1170. It's a comprehensive compilation, really a summary of the entire Talmud, arranged in such a fashion that not only is the Rambam's psak known, but to assiduous students who are meticulous in analyzing every word and every phrase, and even the juxtaposition of paragraphs in the Rambam, be able to deduce the Rambam's Svara as well. The whole corpus of Jewish law was divided into 14 parts, the Yad HaChazaka, Yud Dalid, the Rambam's only work that was written in Hebrew and written with inconceivable organization and concision. Hundreds of commentaries have been written on the Mishneh Torah, perhaps the first by the Rambam's contemporary known as Raivid III, who was from Provence, who was a Rosh Yeshiva in Poquier, and in his writings he stridently critiqued the Baal HaMor, only when the Baal HaMor was alive, and then the Mishneh Torah, sparing no words, really using harsh invective when he was recorded in his Hasagos on the Mishneh Torah, or on the Baal HaMor, harsh invective when he disagreed with something. I've learned that today we're much more squeamish about such things. One is not allowed to criticize the statement or psak or action of any Torah personality. I was even accused of Lashon Hara recently when I did such a thing. What they realized in the time of the Rishonim, and we should as well, is that Amita Shel Torah, the truth of Torah, stands by itself, and the stakes in Torah are very great, and the pettiness of he said this and she said that really amounts to nothing at all. Now, in response to most criticisms, the Rambam defended himself, but as a lover of truth. To others, he made slight changes to the text of the Mishneh Torah. So hence the manuscripts written in the Rambam's own hand that have different wording in different places. Not many, but enough that you have different manuscripts of the Rambam in his own hand. The Rambam also answered questions from across the world. He was the Gadol Hador. To the Jews of Marseille, for example, he wrote that the study of astrology that was completely false, borderline idolatrous, and beneath any intelligent person, much less an intelligent Jew. To one person who said, what should they do in his shul when people don't stop talking during davening? So the Rambam said they should daven a Hoicha Kedusha even for Musaf on Shabbos if people can't keep quiet. To one disciple, if you like that idea, to one disciple, Rabbi Yosef ibn Aknin, he wrote the Mor Nevuchim. The Mor Nevuchim is essentially a work written to one person from which we benefit, to an attempt to reconcile the Torah and current philosophy, especially the ideas of Aristotle and some contemporary Islamic philosophers like Averroes, ibn Rushd, who was the most prominent Muslim scholar of the day, and like Rambam, a Cordovan, in fact, they're contemporaries. Now, people unthinkingly assert that Rambam was an Aristotelian, which is a gross misstatement. Rambam was a Talmud Chacham. Rambam respected Aristotle. He accepted Aristotle's views when they accorded with the Torah. He dissented from them when they did not. But what he did was he reckoned with Aristotle as the dominant philosophical trend of the era, but he certainly did not embrace it fully. The Rambam lived by one credo. Well, maybe more than one, but certainly this one. Kabela so emes mimisha omra. You accept the truth from whoever says it, whatever the source, because truth is truth. And that itself became controversial to non-thinkers. So the Rambam essentially explained the Torah in a way that Aristotelians could, for the most part, accept, dealing with creation and prophecy and providence, as well as the rationale underlying the mitzvos, in a way that's truly indispensable. Even if later generations did not accept every point, at least they had to deal with it. And for us, the Rambam established a pattern of thought and epistemology, in a sense, that is relevant even if Aristotelian physics is no longer. And that is, Jews would try to harmonize or synchronize modern science with the Torah. Whatever the modern science of the day is, we try to understand it in light of the Torah, understanding that science changes, but the Torah doesn't change. Since God is the creator of both Torah and nature, there can be no conflict. But we can utilize the science of the day without being bound by it in an effort to understand the Torah in every generation. Now, that was, probably still is, controversial. Even more, the Rambam was a world-famous figure. As a philosopher, a scholar, a physician, his medical writings were republished, I think, just 20 years ago or so. And to have such an internationally known and revered figure like the Rambam, probably the most quoted Jew of the last 3,000 years, to have him was no small feat for a nation that was being hounded across the world, and even for a person who himself was suffering the effects of persecution. But he was controversial. He was a strong but kind personality, but with a fierce attachment to truth. So he confronted head-on the strong Karaite community in Egypt, and he fearlessly broadcast their heresies. And the Rambam wore himself out in a way that is sad to read. He described in a letter to Shmuel ibn Tibon his average day when he worked as a physician to Salah ad-Din's vizier in the Cairo, Al-Fadl. And he said that he leaves before dawn, leaves his home in Old Cairo, where Jews lived, traveled to Tchumei Shabbos, 4,000 amos, to the palace, where he spends the day tending to the king and his children, what he calls the inmates of his harem, and some of the officers. He said, I returned to Frostat, almost dying with hunger, late in the afternoon, and there he finds a waiting room filled with Jews and non-Jews who seek his counsel on all matters until almost midnight, after which he learns and he writes, and he starts the day again before dawn. His only day of rest, he said, the only day that he can teach Torah to the community was Shabbos. By the year 1200, the Rambam was bedridden, limited to correspondence, and he died in 1204. Body was carried to Tveria, the seat of the Sanhedrin, when it will be reestablished in Herab Yomenu. Now, the primary criticisms lodged against the Rambam was, of course, the Aristotelian claim, his failure to source the Mishneh Torah, the first such work. He saw it as a work which, if not supplanting the Talmud, at least would make study of Talmud less necessary because everything was there in front of you. His reluctance to write at any length in the Mishneh Torah or the Mor Nevuchim on Tchiyas HaMeisim, on resurrection, led to a torrent of criticism that the Rambam denied that Yisod. Now, even though it's one of his Yedim LiKarim, and even though he says in Hilchos Tshuva, in Perek Gimel, that the person who denies Kofit Chias HaMesim has no Chek Lom Abba, even wrote the Maimer Chias HaMesim about his views on it, it made no difference to his detractors, and they were many, well, not all, not most, but many Jews. The next century would see the Rambam's books burned, and burned by Jews, a terrible indictment of the time and of his critics, and really an eerie foretaste of the book burnings that would devastate Jewish life in the 13th century. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was no mystic, said it was clear to him that the Mishnah Torah was written with Ruach HaKodesh, with divine inspiration, because it was unfathomable how else it could have been produced by one single person. Rambam was a unique and unparalleled figure. Finally, something else came into the Jewish world in the 12th century. Provence, mentioned before, in southern France, became a Torah center, and under Ravid III, that's the Rambam's protagonist, it became a center of Kabbalah as well. So that discipline, a mystical interpretation of the Torah that purported to reveal the inner secrets of the Torah and creation, the nature of God, now centered on the Sefer Yetzirah. Zohar would not come into existence for another century or so, but it began having a substantial impact on Jewish life. The Ravid's son, Rabbi Yitzchak Saginohar, he was blind, was the leading Kabbalist in Provence after his father. The Kabbalah soon spread to Spain and to Germany, where the Kabbalists were known as the Hasidei Ashkenaz, the pious men of Ashkenaz. Prominent among them, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, 1150 to 1217, author of the Sefer Hasidim, an ethical will that he left for his son that popularized certain practices until today amongst Ashkenazic Jewry. Even it was only meant for his son. So for example, one point he admonished his son, don't name a child after someone who's living. And that became a minig Ashkenaz, to name after someone who's deceased. Another common minig with just very often royals people, if somehow they don't realize it at first, he told his son he's not allowed to marry a woman who has the same name as his mother, all right? Or vice versa. So maybe once every other day I get a question, can I go out on a date with, Jane, my mother's Jane, what can I do? So of course, Rav Moshe spoke about this already in Struvos. He only meant it for his children, not for all of Ashkenaz. But nonetheless, many Ashkenaz follow that as well. To us, Rav Yehuda HaChassid is also known as the author of the Shi'ar Kavod, Anam Zemiros. And you could tell the Kabbalistic influences that exist in Anam Zemiros. The customs of reciting the Shi'ar Kavod vary from community to community. Some don't say it at all. Some just say Rosh Hashanah Yom HaKippurim because of its sublimity. Others say it every Shabbos, but as you know, we say it on Shabbos. And who sings it? A child. Because only the purity of a child can relate that. An adult could not. With Kabbalah, of course, especially in the Ashkenazic world at the time, came the baggage of Kabbalah. The amulets, the special prayers, the emphasis on the Hebrew letters and the angels that are an enigmatic and, might I say, sometimes troubling part of Jewish life today. Well, what a century. Tremendous intellectual creativity of Jews balanced against constant harassment and persecution and pogroms and the like. The descendants of Rashi, leaders of Ashkenaz like Rabbeinu Tam and Rashbam, the world of the Rambam, the giant of the Sardin and all Jewry, the growth of Kabbalah as a work of study, and to the mainstream of Jewish life a little later on. It was a century that saw the Kuzari and the Ibn Ezra and the flourishing of the Bali Tosfos in France and Germany and Provence, the Gadol of Spain and North Africa. It's hard to imagine a century where such scholarship flourished amid such hardship. But we'll see that again as well. No doubt it's a testament to both the perseverance of Klal Yisrael and the strength afforded a people by Hashgacha Pratis. I thank you all very much. Next week we'll look at the 13th century.